The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
Spider silk made from a goat implanted into humans.
Exactly.
Yes, Homer Simpson's spider pig, or something very like it, looks like it might not have been such a fanciful idea. I'll be joined by the author and broadcaster Adam Rutherford to talk synthetic biology. And...
I like to say it's perilously close to a perpetual motion machine, but it's... I risk ruining whatever reputation I have by saying things like that.
We get an insight into the mind of a Nobel laureate. Frank Wilczek takes us on a ride through his latest theoretical idea. Ever heard of time crystals? You will have after this program's done with you. Also with us is the Observer's science man, Robin McKee, to discuss why Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park was on the money when it came to leaping lizards. And we celebrate even more discoveries of even more exoplanets. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. If you're listening to this programme on the prescribed Monday, then you'll have a treat in store tomorrow. The BBC's Horizon series will feature a brave and morally complex frontier in biology, where goats have spider DNA inserted into them to produce spider web proteins in their milk, and industrial diesel is secreted by beer-brewing yeasts. The programme is presented by Adam Rutherford, a semi-regular of these parts, and he's here to tell me all about his travels in making the film. Welcome back to Science Weekly, Adam. How long has it been since you were last here?
It's more than a year, I think.
What have you been doing?
Well, I've been making this TV programme.
Okay, good. So we've talked about synthetic biology on this programme lots of times before, over many years. It's something that we're deeply interested in, has lots of applications. Why don't you set this stall for us? What is it? What does it mean in 2012? What is synthetic biology?
Well, it's good that you've been talking about it, because I think it is one of the badly kept secrets of science at this point in time. It's an area that I think most people don't really know about, but is happening at a pace that needs to be looked at. I don't find it terrifying, but it's something that the public really have no conception of on the whole. And so these stories about what we can do with genetic modification are now in the public domain, but poorly understood. But the technology has moved on to such an extent with synthetic biology that scientists are now doing things which were impossible and even inconceivable even 5 years ago. And that's really what the program is about. That's why I think synthetic biology is singularly the most important area of science.
I mean, it essentially is the application of engineering principles to what is a wet subject, biology. I don't mean wet as in it's not hard, but I mean wet as in, you know, some cells and hormones and
sure.
All sorts of molecules and complex things.
Sure.
And give us a bit of a potted history. I mean, you mentioned genetic modification. That is a form, I suppose, of modifying biology, but that's been around for a while. What is synthetic biology different? What's different about it?
Your description, which is accurate, is that's the purest form of it. I think the term itself has come to mean all ends, extreme ends of genetic engineering. And in fact, the film that we've made covers stuff which doesn't necessarily qualify as synthetic biology, but is definitely slightly peculiar forms of genetic engineering, such as spider goat.
We'll come to that.
I'm sure that we will. The purest form, the origin of synthetic biology as a specific field, is exactly as you said, applying engineering principles, and in particular electrical engineering principles, to biological systems. And so radically stripping out the noise that is inherent in complex biology, that our cells our metabolism is very noisy, it's a messy system. The idea behind synthetic biology is to strip out all of that noise and reduce these genetic circuits and components into pure engineering products. So you can take any genetic element or any gene and physically take it and put it next to another one and create logic circuits that work in exactly the same way as logic boards do on computers. I think we're at a stage now where the first papers with serious applications are emerging from this very purest world of engineering in synthetic biology.
So there's been some time that scientists have spent standardizing, extracting the sort of individual components and all of that. It's all based around DNA. How important, for example, was the sequencing of the human genome and projects like that to actually sequence things quickly, create bits of DNA quickly? That must have been an important part of this too, because technology to create sequences has only been around for a decade or so, at least in industrial quantities.
Yeah, that's mostly true, and I think the human genome, the input of the human genome to all biology cannot be underestimated. This is a process where you're stripping out so much of the information and just reducing what are biological parts to their purest form. And so, for example, there was a paper in September in Science from a group at MIT, Ron Weiss, one of the characters in our film, where they design a system, a logic system, where it identifies a cell as being a cancer cell by using five logical components. If this, then yes. If this, then yes. And if it does that five times, then it knows that it's a cancer cell, a particular type of cancer cell. And at that point, it then says, if a cancer cell, then release toxin, which will destroy the cell. So you have this very targeted system of destroying a tumor, which is the exact opposite of the sort of blunderbuss approach of chemotherapy, which shoots thousands of cells and huge organs, because it's just not very focused. So you have, you know, this logic system, this engineering principle that allows you to target individual cells rather than, you know, a whole mass of tissue. And I think this is inevitably going to be the future.
And it's in the applications, I think, where the power of this technique is most apparent. In the film, you also went to NASA. Tell us what you saw there.
Yeah, NASA, as always, some of the most forward-thinking technologists. Using this new technology of synthetic biology for applications, right? So you're absolutely right. This is an applications-based technology. So one of the most pressing problems for space exploration is astronauts being exposed to radiation, cosmic rays and solar radiation, which is why they wear such big suits. So one of the teams at NASA, Ames, in outside of San Francisco, was to use synthetic biology to address this. And what they have done is they have designed and built what's called a biocapsule, which is about a centimetre long and about half a millimetre wide, made of carbon nanotubes, carbon nanofibers. And inside there, they haven't got to this stage yet, but the idea is that inside there, there will be cells, bacterial cells, with synthetic biology circuits within them, which will respond to cosmic radiation by releasing cytokines, which is the body's natural way to treat radiation poisoning. So the cells will be contained within the biocapsule. The biocapsule will be contained within the astronaut under the skin permanently. And so when they're exposed to radiation from space, the treatment for it is already within them and is stimulated by the cause of the illness itself. It's an incredibly elegant and sophisticated
system. How close is something like that, which sounds very complicated, but, you know, logically possible? How close is that to a real application? I mean, does it have to go through the same sorts of tests as a pharmaceutical, or is it a medical implant? Or how do these things get regulated?
Well, in exactly the same way as a drug would. Where they're at, I asked exactly that question to the researchers. The capsule works. Right? They've made that. I made one in the lab and during the film. They're very easy to make now that they've designed the system to work. They haven't made the synthetic biology aspect to it yet, but they're talking about clinical trials, which would initially be on animals, within 2 to 5 years, which means if they work, human trials within 5 to 10 years, which means this is technology that
we
will
all
have in
15 years. Where could this go? What would you do with it?
Well, apart from it's a very valid and good question. That apart from being able to, this is technology for astronauts. The medical applications for this are immediate, obvious, and really impressive. So, the first one that I thought of when I was listening to the description of how this would work was for diabetics, for diabetes. We know how to treat diabetes, but diabetics have to inject themselves with insulin. If you can create a cell with a synthetic circuit within it that produces insulin, put that inside the biocapsule, embed it under your skin of someone with diabetes, you have a potentially lifelong treatment for diabetes, which is totally non-invasive. You never need to do anything other than have that capsule under your skin.
Now, people who may sort of dip into the idea of synthetic biology once in a while or have heard of it in the periphery of the stuff they come across will have heard of a certain scientist, Craig Venter. He was in the headlines a few years ago because he had so-called made life. Adam, what's your thinking on this? Is he a synthetic biologist, A, and B, is what he's doing the sort of stuff that you saw, or is it different to that?
It is different. It doesn't fall under the tight definition of synthetic biology. What he did with Cynthia, which is...
JCV1 or something, wasn't it?
Mycoplasma mycoides JCV1.10 sin-dash... Oh, I can't quite remember.
1.0.
Something there like you that. Go. Right, which is a goat pathogen. It's a bacteria which causes mastitis in goats, but it has a very small genome. And what he did was an exquisite piece of genetic engineering and genetic synthesis of DNA. I don't think that it qualifies as creating life. I think at best you can describe it as rebooting life. The thing about Venter is that he's incredibly good at PR and he's incredibly good at generating headlines. He is also, it should be said, he gets a lot of stick for those two things, but he is also an incredibly good scientist. And this piece of work, Cynthia, is a really important technical achievement. It shows that we are capable of not just stringing a couple of genes together, it shows that we're capable of manufacturing an entire genome, albeit the smallest genome that we know of. But nevertheless, this is, you know, a supreme technological achievement. It shows quite how good we are at manipulating DNA.
Robin?
The trouble is he tries to patent it, doesn't he? And that's what causes a great deal of unhappiness. Professor John Sulston being one of those particular critics of that work.
That is true. That is true. So that comes with his history. So when the Human Genome project was happening in the late 90s and published in 2001, Venter was running a simultaneous private endeavor with his company at the time, which was called Celera. And their idea was to do exactly the same using a slightly different technique, possibly using some of the data from the public consortium. But that would be a private venture. Now, Cynthia is owned by him. So he does, you're right, Robin's absolutely right, he gets a lot of shtick because he works almost exclusively in the commercial domain. On the other hand, his grand scheme for Cynthia and this minimal genome project that he's been working on is to create a template, a living template on which you can add functions. Now that really is a synthetic biology project. So you have it's like creating a basic chassis for a car that is then available to pimp with whatever you want. And what he's really interested in is dealing with energy production and environmental issues. You know, he does get a lot of shtick. I don't think he's a bad guy. I do think he does good science, but it is all masked by the amount of hype that goes around, that follows his projects around, which I think it's fair to say is not discouraged by his organisations.
Well, let's move away from the hype then and talk about some more serious applications again. This spider goat of yours.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, it's a serious application. Tell us about spider goat.
Right. So, yeah, spider goat is a real thing. It's been around for a few years.
These aren't my words, but it starts your piece in The Observer.
Well, I think we felt in the film that this was one of the most striking examples of what we can do with genetic engineering now. In fact, the technology isn't that new. It's cloning, but it's done in a bigger animal than mice, which is what most scientists use most of the time. And the genes that they're putting in are the genes that make spider webs in spiders. So they have, in this farm at the University of Utah, in very rural, proper farming Utah, a place that I've never been or experienced before. It is a little bit like Brokeback Mountain, but that's not really the type of thing you say to these guys. I mean, they are proper farmers as well, so they're geneticists who come from farming stock. And there they are. They've got a bunch of goats that have been genetically modified to produce spider silk in their milk. And that's what we did. We milked them, and then you process
it. You milked
one? Yeah, I milked a goat. It was the first time I milked a goat, and it wasn't just any old goat. It was a spider goat. So it was a strange day for me, that. You take the milk, you process it to remove all of the fats and proteins other than the spider silk proteins, and then by a not particularly complex process, you get a glass rod and dip it into this clear liquid, and out comes a single thread of spider silk.
And it's real spider silk?
It's spider silk.
Molecularly the same?
It's not absolutely identical. It's not, the physical properties are not 100% the same. They're reduced, and they can't get them at the same length. But the elasticity is comparable, and it work. It's spider silk.
It's worth talking about the sort of ethical and regulatory parts of this this subject as well. You mentioned at the top of the conversation that it's something, synthetic biology is happening. It's happening fast. There are lots of papers being published. Perhaps members of the public aren't too aware of all of the issues coming along. What are the things that are going to be problematic, or not problematic, but are going to be raised in the next few years as these technologies come to the fore? You've mentioned all these great applications, but at some point someone's going to say, hang on, stop, where are we going with this? What's going to come up, and who's tackling it?
Right, well, I think the arguments are the same as they've ever been for all genetic modification type issues. I haven't come across any different scientific arguments that are for synthetic biology that are distinct from the same arguments that get perpetrated for genetic modification.
I suppose the difference in one respect is that, as you said, there are going to be applications that you couldn't have conceived of, and there will be even more that we can't conceive of. So how do you go about integrating this into society safely?
My personal opinion is that you don't regulate in advance. You this is The Guardian and I am a wishy-washy liberal. My feeling is that you educate and that you have informed public discourse. I don't think that ever happened with genetically modified foodstuffs in this country, and that conversation was hijacked before it really happened with scientists involved. That never happened in the States, and 70% of foods have GM produce within them. I think that it's important that people understand that this technology is happening, and that for the most part, it will be used for the benefit of everyone. There is one issue within this which I do find problematic, and it is the speed at which this is being commercialized. So there's an interesting phenomenon within synthetic biology, which is that those parts that we were talking about, stripping out all of the biological noise and reducing them to component parts, is a very democratic thing. There's a BioBricks Foundation, which is based in Stanford and MIT, have free availability for all of these parts. Anyone who's registered, mostly scientists, I think exclusively scientists, can take those parts and they can string together.
Just explain what a biobrick is.
So a biobrick is one of those units. It can be a gene, it can be a different type of DNA component, but basically it is a thing that you look at on a catalogue page on the web, and it says, it's fully characterised, and it says, this does X.
A bit like a transistor or a little switch or whatever.
Absolutely. So you could find a piece of DNA which says, I produce a blue colour. Right, and then next to that, you might find a piece which says, "I turn a gene on in the presence of glucose." So the idea would be that you put glucose into that circuit, and it produces a blue colour.
And you've got a detector.
That's the simplest type of synthetic biology application. Right, all of that stuff is freely available. It's all open source. It's all open access. And there's this great sort of democratic free movement that is promoting this as a technology. At exactly the same time, you've got enormous megalith companies emerging that are using the same technology to produce commercial products. Now, I'm not saying that that is necessarily a bad thing, but what I do think, this is my opinion, is that the two biggest commercial endeavors in synthetic biology are drug production and fuel production, right? So the balance of power, there is no transfer of the balance of power away from the way that it already exists, which is that you have huge megalithic companies producing drugs in the old-fashioned way now and digging oil out of the ground. And what I think we're seeing quite rapidly is that the new technology to produce these same products synthetically or using synthetic biology is simply transferred to new mega corporations. And I think that that is something that we need to be wary of.
Big thanks to Adam Rutherford there. If you want to watch his fascinating and provocative programme, Horizon Playing God, that goes out on Tuesday the 17th of January on BBC Two and also on the BBC HD channel. After that, it'll be available on the BBC iPlayer. And now for something completely different.
I'm David Rosenberg, and I've just finished making a podcast as part of the BodyPod series, which is a Fuel production. And this podcast focuses on the ear.
My name is David McAlpine. I'm the director of the UCL Ear Institute. And with David Rosenberg, I've been working on how you can actually use sound to create a sense of space.
I've tried to construct the podcast so that there are different sounds that are coming from different places at the same time, and that draws attention to this three-dimensional perception of those sounds.
So when we were creating the illusions of sound being out there somewhere, even though you're wearing a pair of headphones, we put microphones into the two ears, and we record the sound as stereo sounds. And that two-eared or binaural recording allows us to recreate, inside your headphone space, the illusion of sounds being somewhere out in the environment.
In a room with no furniture.
You.
And with walls covered in chaperone.
And this is what it sounds like being Michelangelo.
The thing that's very interesting about the collaboration with the neuroscientist is that he would talk about different physiological effects and auditory illusions and how to use those in order to draw attention to certain things or to create surprises for an audience.
I think what's been fascinating about the project, working with David, has been the view that you can actually fool all of the people all of the time. So the compelling nature of your brain taking over from your common sense, if you like, is actually brought home to me more and more. And I think that's what's very useful in the theatre. You can actually grab people's brains, if you like, their perception, and manipulate it.
To get a very different perspective on science, check out the body pods that are going out on the Fuel Theatre website. That's fueltheatre, all one word, .com. It's that time in the show when we look at some of this week's most interesting science stories. Adam Rutherford's still here with us, and we're joined by the Observer's Science and Technology editor, Robin McKee. Welcome to you both. So let's talk about some of this week's most exciting news stories. Robin, let's start with you. Apparently, there's a planet on average around every star in the Milky Way. Tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah, this is a survey called the Microlensing Network for the Detection of Small Terrestrial Exoplanets, or MINDSTEP. And it's used microlensing, which is a produced when space-time is warped near a star, and you can actually occasionally get a bit of a glimpse, a close-up glimpse of another star. And it detected a few planets around a very few stars, which in itself is perhaps not that interesting, but using that as a statistical kind of sampling, they were able to suggest that almost every star in the Milky Way, in our galaxy, has at least one planet. In other words, there are billions of planets out there in our galaxy, just ready for us to make contact with those that have living things on them.
Now, bearing in mind that our own solar system has 8 planets and multiple sort of mini planetoids or whatever else you want to call them, that doesn't mean that every single star will have something.
No, I think it would be very foolish to say that every star has, but on average, you could say that.
And it's an incredible feat of space engineering, actually, to be able to follow these stars, track them, and it's only happened in the last decade or so.
Yes.
We maybe have something like nearing 1,000 planets that have been confirmed, one or two every single week. And before 20 years ago, I mean, people did not know that other planets even existed anywhere else.
Yeah, this is the problem. We live around a star that has several planets, but you don't know whether we're living in a very special place or we're just living in some very boring kind of suburban arm of the galaxy. The answer would seem to be the latter. We are just a sort of routine star with a routine number of planets.
This is that next big revolution of science, isn't it? Where the Galileo started a long time ago. We're not the centre of the universe. We're nothing special about us at all. Darwin had his go. There's nothing special about our DNA. Right. Then this is another one, the Kepler mission. When there's nothing special about our planets either. Adam? Yeah.
Well, we haven't found any planets which are about the same size or about that may sustain life yet, but that is largely to do with the fact that we can't see with enough resolution. The main way that we discover exoplanets is by looking at how the shadow they cast as they go in front of the star. It's called a transit. And we're going to get a massive boost in 2012 in that technology as well, because Venus will transit across our own sun. And it does this in pairs, separated by 7 years and then 100 years. So the last time we did it was 2004, but before that it was in the 19th century. But what this is a great opportunity for planetary scientists to look at how we actually see exoplanets in the first place, because we can look at a planet that we know
essentially
lots about.
It's casting a shadow across the sun.
Right, it's moving across the face of the sun, and we can see the shadow, so you can tell lots about what that object actually is.
Yes. Is that something that we're going to be able to see from the Earth? I mean, could amateur astronomers watch that?
Yes, you have to be very, very careful. You have to find a method for masking the solar radiation, but you can buy these. They look like little sheets of, you know, circles of metal, and you put that. Make sure you don't catch any of the sun's light on your eye.
It's hard. But
you have to be very careful. But once you've done that, you don't need magnification. The dot is perceptible.
Yeah, we should be clear. You shouldn't look at the sun. Let's just say that again. You should not look at the sun directly,
especially on the 6th of June, 2012, which is when this is going to happen.
So, where's the sort of best place to look at this?
This is going to be in the Pacific, I think. We will get the tail end of it, though, of the transit, in Britain.
Now, the other thing is, I suppose, that in the next 20 or 30 years, more telescopes are going to go into space. There are going to be bigger telescopes on the ground that will actually be able to image some of these exoplanets and look at what's in their atmospheres, what chemicals are in there, maybe even take pictures. I mean, we're going to find out, possibly, if the conditions exist, at least, for life forms elsewhere. Are you willing to make a bet, either of you?
Well, I won't be here because I'm so old, so I'll safely say, yeah, we're definitely going to do it.
No, I think synthetic biology is going to sort you out, trust me. Synthetic biology of whiskey or something will sort you out. Go on, take a risk. What would you think?
Well, I think you're probably right. I think we're going to find planets that will fit our known criteria for life, which are basically Earth, in the next, I don't know, couple of decades. I think it's more interesting to look in our neighbourhood. Though I think we're going to find more interesting things about the origins of life on Earth by looking initially on Earth, but also by looking at Mars. And I think
you mean we need to find life on Earth first.
I think we need to try and recreate the conditions on which life emerged on Earth. The only place that we absolutely know that life does exist is this planet. Well, that's where we need to start.
That's a big question itself, isn't it? How did what is the moment of creation of life on this planet? We still don't actually know that. Come on, scientists, pull your finger out.
Yeah, the experiment that is going to answer that question is occurring right now, about 500 yards from where we're sitting in the studio at UCL. And
it's going to answer it, do you think?
I think it's the best attempt so far in 100
years.
It's
not the same thing as answering it, is it?
scientists don't look for answers. It's the journey. But I think in the next couple of years, we're going to make some serious progress in understanding where life on Earth.
Are you talking hydrothermal vents here?
I am. Yeah. And you can read my book on the subject from February next year.
We will go into this subject again at some point in the future. Let's move on to another story, though. Adam, you've brought a story along from Nature magazine.
Yeah, this has all the elements that I want from a science story. It has lizards, it has robots, and it has dinosaurs. Basically, a team in California at Berkeley have answered the long-standing question of how medium-sized dinosaurs use their tails during jumping. I know this is something
that's long-standing question.
I know this is something that's been bothering you for a long time.
I've been awake at night worrying about nothing else. You know,
how go on, the fuck have did it, they have do they that? Done it?
Well, it's been a 40-year hypothesis within paleontology, but it's an awesome experiment which also should not be repeated by amateurs, where basically they took some lizards and chased them off a cliff. And then filmed them with high speed photography to see what they do with their tails during flight. And the next stage, the experimental stage, is actually greasing the ramp so that they lose their footing as they're getting to the edge of the cliff and go into a slight spin, and then watching what they do with their tails. And then using a tiny remote control car, with a tail and driving that off the cliff to see if they can actually model what the lizards are doing. And it turns out that these lizards, which are called red-headed agamas, use their tail to control pitch during falling or jumping in exactly the same way that the velociraptors did in Jurassic Park in 1993. So a rare occasion.
So it was right?
Absolutely spot on.
That's incredible.
And we've checked the footage as well. We've got Jurassic Park at Nature that we've been watching, and they use the way Spielberg did it in the film is exactly the way that lizards do in
real
life.
What do they
do? Well, basically they twist their body slightly and then raise their tails, which allows them to move through the air and right themselves. And if the experimenters didn't cut the tails off the lizards, but what they did is they used the robot with the tail attached to it and switched the tail off to watch what happens when the robot doesn't have tail control, and basically they hit the wall.
So let me get this right. It's okay, they chased the lizards off the cliff, but they didn't cut the tails off in the end.
Yes. Well, it's not a huge cliff.
What does it say at the end of the experiment? A lot of animals were injured in the making of
this
experiment.
Well, this is my question. I've got two questions. What were the ethical sort of questions these people asked themselves before they did this?
Yeah.
You know, and number two, there's a robot dinosaur somewhere in Barclay that we should become a toy or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Christmas.
We made a little video of it because the experimental setup is awesomely cool. The cliff isn't as big as I've made out. It's about 6 inches. But you've got...
It's not a cliff, really. It's more of a...
It's a lizard.
It's a little lizard.
It's a step.
But then you've got these guys standing... So there's a little runway, and the lab techs stand at the end holding the lizard and release it and sort of... You know, chase it down so it runs away from them, up the ramp, and then flies off into space. Now, that is how science should be done, chasing lizards off ramps.
And then greasing the ramp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To make it even harder.
Well,
awesome.
Do you wonder what the lizards must have been thinking? Why are they doing this? All I wanted to do was climb up a wall. What do they want to know? Look, I'll tell... Oh. Anyway, thanks both of you for those. Fascinating stuff as always. Thanks a bunch to Adam Rutherford and Robin McKee there. To read more of Robin McKee's fine writing, and if you want to read an article by Adam on synthetic biology, pick up this week's Observer. It's available in that stuff we call print. Or you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. Now, last week, you'll remember, I reported from a very important person's 70th birthday. The birthday boy in question was none other than Professor Stephen Hawking. You can check out last week's podcast to hear what happened. But one of the people I spoke to at the celebrations unfortunately got snipped out of the final mix by that nasty producer Jason. I'm not one to willingly leave out chats about theoretical physics, so here's my conversation with one of the world's leading practitioners. MIT's Frank Wilczek is a Nobel laureate, and at Professor Hawking's scientific seminar in Cambridge, he gave a talk on something called time crystals. Yes, time crystals. So I foolishly caught up with Frank afterwards to ask him more. Now, he's possibly one of the nicest and most approachable and avuncular scientists you'll ever meet. So that kind of tricked me into asking him what a time crystal was.
Ordinary crystals are a very common state of matter. Even matter at low temperatures, or especially actually matter at low temperatures when it settles down and goes into its most favorable energy configuration. So when you remove the thermal agitation. In relativity, we learn that space is the same as time, and well, that's much too crude, but space is related to time. In any case, it suggests itself to ask whether you could have similar phenomena where the description of matter would have to include the possibility that the matter forms periodic structures in time. That at first I thought that would be very easy to arrange. Then I thought it was impossible. Now I think I've seen that it's barely possible, which makes it interesting.
So how close are you to getting a result?
Well, I've got results. I mean, but there are results and results. I mean, I haven't yet sort of vetted it public, you know, put out a paper that's been refereed or anything, but I'm about to. I think the most striking result is that one can realize a fully quantum mechanical system with a definite model that's at least has a caricature resemblance to real materials that exhibits this phenomenon of motion in its lowest energy state. So, I like to say it's perilously close to a perpetual motion machine, but it's so I risk ruining whatever reputation I have by saying things like that. But to make it seem less scary or less bizarre, we already know that when you have superconductors, in certain circumstances, the supercurrent will flow forever. That's not periodic because it's a constant current, but it's close. Something is sort of moving. The model that I have is kind of builds on that phenomenon, but brings it into, makes it something that's truly periodic and yet lasts forever.
And what is the implication of something like this?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it's a whole world. I mean, in physics, we talk about universality classes, and that's the way we like to think about the behavior of matter. And so we try to abstract sort of different qualitative possibilities. So roughly speaking, the idea is, well, you know the idea of phases of water. There's steam and there's water and ice. In fact, ice comes in many forms. Okay, so they have qualitatively different properties that you can discuss, and it's very interesting. So those are different phases of the same substance. And now, but we've developed a very rich description of what the possible phases of matter are that goes well beyond the classification into liquids, solids, and gases, especially at low temperatures. All kinds of exotic quantum phenomena can happen that are subtle distinctions between different forms of matter. So this is one part of the time crystal story is that. But it also has pieces that are classical. I talked about that. There's some interesting facts about classical dynamical systems that I didn't think were known. I don't think were known before. And it turns out, and this is something that Hawking has been very fond of over the years, that in physics it's very frequently been fruitful to think about imaginary time, to turn the variable in our equations, T, which is real in conventional equations, to make it imaginary. This helps to describe phenomena at finite temperature and in many other contexts. And one can also discuss the possibility of crystallization in imaginary time. I think that also is interesting. So I don't know where this is going to lead, really, but I feel like I've landed on a new continent.
Okay, so time crystals, that stumped me too. Here's what I think he was describing. He's basically saying that a normal crystal has a periodic structure in space. Now, in special and general relativity, time is just another dimension, a bit like space. So if you can have periodic structures in space, maybe you can have them in time as well. At least that's what I think. I tried to ask him what the applications of this thing might be. At that point, he looked at me as if I was some simpleton wondering why I'd stepped into this conference. So I just didn't really go any further. But we're going to throw this out to you, dear listeners, many of whom we are sure will have a better grasp of theoretical physics than me. So if you think you can work out what a time crystal is, please post on the blog for this podcast, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. You'll be happy to know that Frank Wilczek will be publishing his paper on time crystals in the coming weeks. And if you Google time crystals as well, we're the only place in the world where you actually find some information out about it. So I genuinely think we've uncovered an entirely new paradigm on this podcast and on the Guardian website. Who says that we're dumbing down? Now, our own crystal of time is dissolving this week. It's time for me to say that we're at the end of this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. Thanks again to Adam Rutherford. His programme, Horizon, Playing God, goes out on Tuesday, 17th of January on BBC Two and also on the BBC HD channel. And after that, will be available on the BBC iPlayer. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.